History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold, and they don't have to if we're willing to intervene. Sometimes that looks like something as simple as one well-timed question that opens up the door to things we might not have anticipated. Our goal has always been to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And once we do that, we see that not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. It's Independence Day weekend as America celebrates birthday number 249. And we always focus on the men and women who maintained that independence. We're going to hear from three men who bled for it in World War II today, three of the more than 16 million Americans in uniform during the war. But in this season of 80th anniversaries, this weekend also marks one that we seldom hear about. Do you know the significance of July 5th, 1945? Most of us don't. But after this hour, maybe we won't forget it. And I know you won't forget the memories from three Purple Heart recipients who all contributed to what made July 5th, 1945 so special. If I mention General Douglas MacArthur, the first three words that probably come to mind for you are, "I shall return." On October 20th, 1944, he fulfilled those words waiting ashore on the island of Leyte in the Philippines. Two of the veterans, whose memories you'll hear today, were there that day as well. It was almost 9 months later, on July 5th, 1945, that the general distributed this communique. "The entire Philippine Islands are now liberated, and the Philippine campaign can be regarded as virtually closed. Some minor isolated action of a guerrilla nature in the practically uninhabited mountain ranges may occasionally persist, but this great landmass of 115,600 square miles, with a population of 17 million, is now freed of the invader. The enemy during the operations employed 23 divisions, all of which were practically annihilated. Our forces comprised 17 divisions. This was one of the rare instances when in a long campaign a ground force superior in numbers was entirely destroyed by a numerically inferior opponent." MacArthur would go on to list every enemy division and point out that the total strength of Japanese forces approximated 450,000 men. He went on to say, "Naval and air forces shared equally with the ground troops in accomplishing the success of the campaign. Naval battles reduced the Japanese Navy to practical impotence, and the air losses, running into many thousands, have seriously crippled his air potential. Working in complete unison, the three services inflicted the greatest disaster ever sustained by Japanese arms. The objects of the campaign were as follows. 1. To penetrate and pierce the enemy's center so as to divide him into north and south, his homeland to the north, his captured Pacific possessions to the south. Each half could then be enveloped and attacked in turn. 2. The acquisition of a great land, sea, and air base for future operations, both to the north and to the south, comparable to the British Islands in its use as a base for Allied operations from the west against Germany. 3. The establishment of a great strangulating air and sea blockade between Japan and the conquered possessions in the Pacific to the south, so as to prevent raw materials from being sent to the north and supply or reinforcement to the south. 4. The liberation of the Philippines with the consequent collapse of the enemy's imperial concept of a greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere, and the reintroduction of democracy in the Far East. 5. The liberation of our captured officers and men and of internees held in the Philippines. And 6. A crippling blow to the Japanese Army, Navy, and Air Force." His final sentence, "All of these purposes were accomplished." So that was 80 years ago on July 5th, 1945. But the cost was steep. More than 20,000 Americans died in the fight to liberate the Philippines. An additional 50,000 were wounded but survived, including the three men from three different divisions whose memories we get to listen to today. We'll start with a medic named Dave Wall. The perspective he would come to carry about his injuries was shaped by an experience before he was ever assigned to the 24th Infantry Division.
During basic training at Camp Barkley, Texas, we had a visiting orthopedic specialist on one occasion spoke to us. He had the battalion strong in there. He described our skeletons, naturally a bone doctor. He started at the tip of our head and went down to our toes, and when he got down to the sternum, he told us that if you find somebody where the sternum has been penetrated like with a bullet, don't worry about that guy because he's dead. And if he isn't, he will be in a few minutes because he's bleeding to death internally. So that message, I think, stuck with me as much as anything that I heard during the basic training session. That was the one thing that stayed with me. Oh, and he started this lecture, which was unusual in the Army. He started by quoting a scripture verse that we find in the book of Psalms, where the psalmist said, "I will praise the Lord, for I am wonderfully and fearfully made. Marvelous are thy works, O Lord, and of that my soul is well aware." So when he quoted scripture, I grabbed onto that, and I listened to him very intently. That's why I heard that speech about a bullet through the sternum.
So that got your attention, and then you were paying attention to hear something that was going to come in handy later?
That is exactly right. That caught my attention and alerted me to what was going on. I remember as the war went on, I think all of us recognized that the old-timers tended to get picked off sooner or later, and I honestly worried whether I would make that trip back to California that I so hoped for. And then there was the one time when I was nicked by a bullet. After we landed on the Isle of Leyte, the first day we landed in the early morning, by mid-afternoon we got word that MacArthur was coming ashore, so a couple of us went back to the beach and watched him wait ashore. He came in on an LCT, landing craft tank, which was a little larger than the rest of us troops were on.
Were you guys on LCVPs, or what'd you hit the shore on?
The LCVP was our trip to the beach.
So this is, you know, MacArthur, when he left the Philippines, had famously said, "I shall return," and this is his triumphant return that's been photographed waiting in on Leyte there.
That is exactly true. I watched him wade ashore and come up to the newsreel camera, which there was a newsreel camera there, and he made his famous speech, "People of the Philippines, I have returned."
And you were how far away?
Two or three arms distance. I was behind the cameraman, in the area right behind the cameraman, and I saw his lip quiver. So I knew that there were feelings there. There were feelings there. Then after MacArthur came ashore, that was our first day. Then it was on the ninth day when the four of us went to pick up this casualty, and we had picked him up and set him on the litter. And then as I moved around to my corner of the litter, I made the mistake of standing to my full 5 feet, 8.5 inches, and pow, I was knocked flat to my back. And there I found myself with my hands over the sternum. Now, naturally, I thought about that lecture, dead or bleeding to death, and I didn't think I was dead. I didn't feel, as a matter of fact, that I was seriously wounded. So I removed my hands and found a groove across the sternum. Now, recognizing that had my body been turned one way or the other, I very likely would have been a dead man.
So in your training, you'd gotten this lecture that you weren't even paying attention to until you heard the Bible verse, but you pay attention, and he says, if anything penetrates the sternum, don't bother with it, that guy's a goner. And now you're what, a fraction of an inch away from something penetrating your sternum?
Well, a fraction of an inch, yes. What can I say? It appeared later that this may have ricocheted slightly. It may have changed the direction. I think that I got the shoulder of the bullet versus the tip. And I think had I gotten the tip of the bullet, I'm a dead man.
So in other words, it came straight across your chest, but didn't penetrate far enough.
That's right, exactly. People tell me I was extra, extra lucky at that time. But I say, well, yes, unless you believe like I do that there was divine intervention. And this is simply the long and the short of it. I had my own private miracle, which I carry with me today.
You have that perspective today, and you just said that. You carry with it today. Is that how you felt at that moment? I mean, did it hit you right away that's what had happened?
As a matter of fact, no. I, as a matter of fact, thought I was just one of the lucky guys, you know. And there were other experiences like that, but none quite as dramatic. And in each instance, I thought, boy, was I lucky I escaped again. I really didn't recognize and realize what was going on. No. I didn't think of it at the time as being divine intervention. I thought of it as being a lucky hombre.
What changed your mind? Because you look pretty convinced of it now.
Well, I think the years that have gone by did it to me. Now, obviously, I'm a lot older now than I was then. And the years and realizing what happened, and it has been called back to my attention.
How serious were you hurt? Did it take you out of action for a while?
As a matter of fact, no. When I saw that it wasn't serious, I jumped to my feet and grabbed the litter, and we made tracks down to the battalion aid station. And I did do this. When the ambulance came to pick up this party, I went with the ambulance back to my company. And for the next week or so, all I did was unload ambulance or goof around or didn't do much of anything during that time. And then our other people came back when the battalion was relieved. And then we were there for another week or so until we went out on the next mission. So I really wasn't. I was out of action for maybe a couple of weeks.
You had a flesh wound that had to heal on your chest?
Yes, it was kind of laughable. It wasn't that serious, you know. So there's a little flesh wound, a little bleeding. So what?
Well, it was enough for them to award you the Purple Heart. Yes. So it wasn't insignificant. But it sounds like you weren't looking for an excuse to get out of action, that you wanted to continue doing what you were doing. Why was that?
Well, I wouldn't say I wanted to, but when they said, let's go, we went. And that is the way with the military. When they say frog, you jump. And it was that simple. When they woke me, I was in a foxhole, and he said, get your stuff together because you're going out. He said, first go down to the mess hall and have your breakfast. So we did. The eight of us that were on detached service had breakfast before we got on the ship and went on the next mission.
And where'd you go from there?
The next mission took us around the other side of the island. And then we went back up through the boonies. There were no roads, no airports, no rivers to go on. And the riflemen hadn't had breakfast. But we were assured that we would be followed by a group of Filipino carriers that would bring us our rations. And this was on a Friday, as I recall. We marched and marched until noontime, always looking back, still no carriers. We marched until evening, still looked back and still no carriers. And then Saturday, we marched and marched till noon and no carriers, until evening and no carriers. Sunday morning, still no food. And we walked till noon, and by then the troops were all pretty tired, and we were not in shape to go on, really. And I guess our commanding officer got somebody on the hose. And within, I'd say, 45 minutes, a couple of C-47s with our biscuit bombers came by and dropped the rations to us. And then we had field rations from then on. Then we went on, took this position up on the hills. There were four hills where we took our positions. We were overlooking what was known as the Ormoc Corridor. And the Ormoc Corridor was the last place the enemy could still get to the ocean and get resupplied or get off the island. So we were told to hold our position there at all cost, and we were up there for 31 days. And during that time, we brought the casualties to the battalion aid station, which was us. And then we got the Filipino carriers each day bringing in rations and ammo and carrying the wounded back out. So we were there for 31 days. And incidentally, the battalion got a presidential citation for that particular mission.
Well, and you kind of nonchalantly threw out that your orders were to hold at all costs, but that is a pretty tall order. And there were a lot of places where people who got that order paid a really heavy cost. And I imagine there were some significant casualties there. Is there something else that enters your mind, or a next level of motivation you think occurs when you get that order, hold at all costs? Because that's not a maybe. That's a pretty absolute.
I think I thought of it much like any other orders that I got. So we hold our position, you know, and we did. And it was uncomfortable, but, you know, what can I say?
And you mentioned earlier how you didn't let some of the emotions get to you. But do you look back at it now and see what you did and say, how in the world did I keep going and going and going and going?
That is a thought. And like I say, at the time, my emotions were totally shut off. Yes, I wonder how I did it. I wonder how I did it and why I did it, Sam. Is that right? Yeah.
And even if you weren't allowing yourself to get too close to some of these guys, I imagine you developed an impression of the kind of people these were, the guys that were dying there, the guys that you were treating that you knew were going to go home and not the same kind of shape they came in. What do you think we need to understand about the kind of people that were over there fighting for freedom?
Okay, that's a good question. I'm not sure how to answer it. We were people. We were no different than anybody else. Young people, to be sure, most of us.
When this fighting's going on, when you're wounded and all this is happening, to put it in context, you're, what, 19 years old?
Yes, I was 19, turned 20 at that time, and I was home and got my discharge the day before my 21st birthday. So I was in at 18 and out at 20 at 21. Now I see 21-year-old kids and 18-year-old kids, and I think, these are kids. But to me, at the time, I thought I was as capable as anybody else, and probably I was for what I had to do.
It's time for our first break, but when we come back, another one of the casualties in the quest to liberate the Philippines, a goal that was accomplished 80 years ago this weekend. We wish you and your family the best Independence Day weekend possible, and we'll be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, celebrating both Independence Day weekend and an 80th anniversary that you might not hear about anywhere else this weekend, July 5th, 1945, the liberation of the Philippines. Let's learn more about the price that was paid in that quest now through the memories of a 1st Cavalry Division veteran named Patch Curtis, who was trying to help liberate Antipolo on the island of Luzon.
The first thing that happened, an A-20A attack plane with a smoke started, and they just laid a smoke screen 10 miles across the face of that mountain. They had 4.2 chemical mortars set up in intervals all down through that 10-mile section, firing red smoke shells. And as these red shells would go up, they were spaced apart. Each unit was supposed to stay in that line that was delineated by these smoke lines. So when they made the blackout, these red lines started up and we were given the order to go. So we went ahead. Now, our particular assignment that day was to take a artillery observation unit from a 155-millimeter howitzer battery and place them on their optimum observation point. We were supposed to escort them up and get them put down on the place where they were supposed to direct the fire from their battery. I had been on patrol in that day before and was most familiar with the area that they wanted to traverse, so I was appointed point. So we started out at 8 o'clock up to the smoke screen after the massive artillery barrage went off ahead of us, and as we went up, the ground was filled with craters 12 to 18 inches deep. Ground looked like it had just been plowed with these shells, but we went on up, and when I say up, it was the base of a mountain, and as you went further up, it got steeper and steeper and steeper. Sure. We were pretty successful and didn't receive too much resistance, and only a couple of firefights on the way up. Till about 11 o'clock, we got up down a particular area. We run into some resistance. The unit commander decided the best way to subdue the Japanese was we had a bazooka section that would fire bazooka shells, a 60-millimeter mortar section, and so they fired up all the bazooka shells. The Japs still continued to fire back at us. All of the mortar shells got used up trying to knock them out, so there weren't any more mortar shells available. So finally, platoon sergeant said to me, "Curtis, take your squad down and see if you can knock them out with grenades." We were up on the lee side of a hill where they couldn't get to us, so I went down the backside and around, and it was kind of an open swale down and a hill up on the backside over here, and I went around. I made sure all of them had four grenades and full belt of ammo and so on. Well, I started out with them down and went around and headed around here, and I said, "Let's pick up the pace. We don't want to be standing around too slow and make a good target." And so we started kind of moving a little faster, and we were firing as we were advancing. And one of my guys stumbled and went down, and as he went down, he almost hit me. He was pulling off shots as he fell down, and I turned and said, "He almost hit me. Get up." And he was down on his hands and knees like this. I kicked him in the behind, and he greatly started to get up and so on. And by then, the first bullet hit me over on the left shoulder here, and I figured, well, we were stopped. We were in wide open space, and we're not moving anymore. We're dead meat. So I started to turn to say, "Let's get out of here." And that's when the bullet hit me in the chest here.
What did that feel like?
It knocked the breath out of me, and I went down on my back. It spun me around. I couldn't get my breath. A fleeting thought went through, "Well, I guess this is it." But for some reason, I got my breath a little bit. Somehow I got initial shock. I guess my heart stopped or something too. I don't know. But anyway, a guy grabbed me by one leg and pulled me back around this point of this little hill and so on. I don't know how they got me back up on the top of the hill in the back. I was unconscious by then. I woke up. I remember the aid man was working on me, and they were giving me some morphine. And I remember when I'd breathe, it was going like that, and I had to try to get my hand over here to close it up.
So you could tell that your lung was punctured?
Well, I didn't know. It just hurt, and I couldn't get my heart to get my breath. I was real short of breath, and I was coughing a little bit, and I was in and out after that. But when one incident, I woke up, and my fellow squad leader, a fellow by the name, my last name was Carmona, he had me in his lap, and the aid man had told him to keep my shoulder up so I wouldn't drown in my own blood. So he was kind of holding me up in his lap. And I heard, "For Christ's sake, Carmona, take your carbine and shoot me. I can't stand this pain." He says, "Well, I'll get the aid man to give you some more morphine." And the aid man, Andy Anderson, he said, "I can't give you any more. It'll stop your breathing." So I said to Carmona, "Take your carbine and shoot me. I can't stand this pain." So that was about 11 o'clock in the morning, as they later on they were able to kind of tell me. That went on all the rest of that day. They wanted to get a stretcher party up, but the Japanese had moved in on the trail behind, and they couldn't bring anybody or no ammunition or anything. They couldn't get anything up to us. They were still in radio communication with the rear, but they couldn't make physical contact because the Japanese had intervened. And they decided that maybe after dark they could circumvent the Japanese. So sometime after dark, they got a stretcher party up there to get me in. And they had took six guys on the stretcher to get me down off of there. So I didn't get down to the 1st Medical Squadron station till somewhere around midnight. And I remember one instance on the stretcher on the way down, I was in and out all the time. But one instance, a problem that I got kind of aroused, they couldn't figure out how to get me down off this level, but somehow they did. They laid us out in the yard before they finally got me into the surgeon, and all I can remember, somebody woke me up enough to say that I was getting my first blood transfusion. They showed me the name on the bottle there, and they read it off to me. Gaius, G-A-Y-E-O-U-S, Gately, G-A-T-E-L-E-Y. Anyway, that was the first blood transfusion that I got.
And what all did they have to do surgically for you?
They didn't really do much except took out quite a few pieces. They reconstructed later on, they told me, what apparently had happened. I had a pair of binoculars on, and the bullet hit the binoculars first and disintegrated partially. So in the stuff that they took out of me was the pieces of binocular castings, piece of glass, leather from my wallet that was in my chest pocket here, piece of paper from stuff that was in the wallet, bullet fragments, and some of the bullet fragments they wrapped up. Here's the dog tags. That's all I got back with.
You were wearing these?
That's what I had on at the time.
You had this dog tag on at the time, and you saved it with the leather strap.
And it's still blood-soaked, and that shoestring is still soaked with my blood.
Wow.
And they were finding all that stuff in me, so apparently the bullet fragment, there's one large piece about as big as my thumbnail still down underneath there, and with that adhesive tape that's wrapped around them there that you see, they had a piece of the bullet fragments that they had found in the outer layers of skin there. All those pieces of stuff that you see shattered through there,
yeah,
that's a good part of that is binocular.
Yeah.
And if it hadn't, the binocular hadn't been on there, it's very likely the bullet would have gone through much cleaner.
And not spread out so much debris
yeah.
in there.
Yeah.
And they had to take out a couple of your ribs?
Yeah, that happened a year and some months after. These two ribs that they took out wouldn't heal. They developed osteomyelitis,
uh-huh.
and they were getting worse and worse.
But basically, the whole right side of your chest
yeah.
is crushed, destroyed,
yeah.
bruised.
Right.
Your lung was damaged.
Right. The first operation, they didn't think there was anything in the lung. It was collapsed. And when the lung collapses, apparently, a hard coating forms on there. And they have to strip all that. They called it a decortication operation. They stripped that off before the lung can re-expand. Apparently they did that, but apparently there was still stuff in there because in January of 1946, I started coughing up blood. They couldn't figure out what that was, but they took a lot of pictures and stuff in there. Again, the Veterans Administration was completely overwhelmed. They couldn't find a bed to put me in. They wanted to send me up to some hospital up way up in Oregon, and I didn't want to go up there because I didn't know anybody. I had the job down there that I thought I would, because I went back to work on January the 1st.
Well, wait a second, though. You went back to work, but I know that one of the other effects of that injury, at least in the immediate aftermath, was you really didn't have the use of your right arm, right?
Yeah, right.
What, what kind of state were you in for the next few weeks after you got hit?
Initial medical help.
Yeah.
I was transferred to the 41st Field Hospital in Quezon City. That was a place to get your feet back underneath you and get a little weight going back and so forth. And I was there for several weeks. They moved us down on the docks in Manila and put us on a hospital ship for a general hospital down in New Guinea, back at Hollandia. I was on this hospital ship on April the 10th, my birthday, on the 12th of April, and the day that President Roosevelt died. That came in over the radio, that President Roosevelt. And then I wound up down in this 54th General Hospital in Hollandia for quite a while. That's where my arm wasn't working.
And when you say it wasn't working, you had no control of it all or no strength?
It was cold. I couldn't lift it. I could feel some. I could move my fingers and so on, but I couldn't do anything with them.
Because there was muscle damage from the shot you
right.
received.
And they also said there was probably some nerve damage,
sure,
which disappeared. That problem disappeared later on.
I'm sure a lot of people are listening to this and they're thinking, well, how long did it take him to recover? And that's probably not a simple question, because in some ways, you probably never recovered.
Yeah, that's right. I'm short 50% of my normal air.
How has that affected your everyday life?
It was interesting as it worked, you know. These eager beaver bosses, you know, when they make a factory tour, they go out at full stride, you know. If I was in one of these parties, you know, by the time we'd get about halfway through a department, I would go, everybody would go, what's the matter with this guy? One other interesting aspect to this mental, I was walking down the aisle one day by the acetylene welding department, and you know when you hang acetylene torch up once in a while, it goes pop, 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 pop. I was walking by, this guy hung up his torch there, and it went pop, 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 and I found myself under this workbench over here.
You thought you were back in the jungle of the Philippines dodging bullets, huh?
Yeah, just like that.
And the other thing I've got to say, I don't want to be melodramatic, but we talked about your four kids and 13 grandkids and 30 great-grandkids. And after hearing your story, it sure seems like it's a miracle that any of them were ever born, because most people wouldn't have survived what you went through. And it sounds like it took a lot of help from a lot of other people to save your life.
That's absolutely true. I've had help all of my life. And that's another thing I marvel at. My grandmother picked me up after my mother died. My friends in San Francisco picked me up after I lost my place on the ranch. On and on and on and on.
And those guys had to drag you out of the spot where you got hit.
Yeah.
And they're risking their own lives in doing so.
Absolutely. All the way. And all the other people down the line that have ever had anything to do with. And you, now here, you're helping me spread the word, which is something I believe in. We need a lot of improvement in our patriotism in this country. We are in a wonderful country that we live in, and you only have to see the results of occupation like occurred in the Philippines that other countries do to you, and what it might have been like had they been successful in doing that to us, including the Japanese and the Germans.
For those of us who weren't alive during World War II, who didn't see any of this, who didn't understand what could have been and what almost was, what do you think we need to know about you and all the guys like you who risked their lives for our country?
I would like to hope that we could all be aware of what it took, of what it was and what they did, and order their lives accordingly, and also somehow gather the feeling that they too could make a contribution like that if they were called on to do that.
You've made it very clear how close you came to not coming home, to adding to that number of over 400,000 Americans who died in World War II. How often over the years have you thought about some of those guys you knew who didn't come home?
Almost every day. For example, this Carmona that I mentioned, he lies in the Roswell Cemetery. He was given a Silver Star for his action the next day after I was wounded in killing the Japanese that stopped me. The other one that I turned up, I mentioned earlier that I stepped aside to let my BAR man shoot this first Japanese. He received a Distinguished Service Cross for his actions on March the 9th, along with Carmona, and subduing the Japanese strong point.
And am I understanding that they were both killed that day?
They were both killed. They were both awarded their awards of Silver Star and Distinguished Service Cross posthumously.
And with Carmona, so people remember, you're saying he was killed the day after you were hit, but what you shared with us is that he was one of those who helped save your life by cradling you and holding you upright so you didn't drown in your own blood.
Absolutely. And a day later, he was dead. So I forever have a debt to him. I think about some of this stuff every day.
It's time for our final break, but we have one more Purple Heart story from the Philippines when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328.
honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
People of the Philippines, I have returned.
General Douglas MacArthur spoke those words on October 20th, 1944. But it wasn't until July 5th, 1945, 80 years ago this weekend, that the Philippines were officially liberated. We've already heard from two of the more than 50,000 Americans who were wounded but survived that fight for freedom. Here comes one more. Joe Garabedian's parents had survived the Armenian Genocide 30 years earlier. He felt very fortunate to survive his combat in the Philippines with the 96th Infantry Division.
Fortunately, when we landed on Leyte, there was no beach fighting. We were kind of tickled about that. But the coxswains were very happy, too, because they can back off and bring another load in. You can imagine they had to make quite a few trips. That was a hectic time of the war, whether you're going to make it or not. And your question was, what do you think about? What do you think about every morning? I'm still alive. Will I be alive tonight? Four of my outfit died. Why am I here? I'm right there. I got shot through my brachial plexus, which are all your nerve center, and come out and just miss my spine.
Did you know what you were getting into? I don't know if people today understand all that went into a machine gun outfit in those days.
Well, whether it's a rifleman or whether it's a machine gunner, you had to tear that machine apart, blindfolded, and put it back together in the dark on a Grand rifle, which is one of the best rifles in the Army because it was automatic and gas-propelled, better even than Germany, who had a bolt action. We never had bolt action. Ours was automatic. You just pulled the trigger. On the machine gun, you have to take it apart, blindfolded, lay the parts down on the table. The most dangerous thing in there is a spring about 16 inches long. You don't pull the trigger when you lift. Well, let me say like this. I've been saying it for years and years. Bolts forward, covers down. The second gunner puts the belt through. You cock it. That's bolt forward, covers down. And all you got to do is just lift that up. The spring will push it forward. And when it goes forward, the firing pin hits and the power, the blow, pushes it back. So that's 650 times a minute. But we were told, don't sleep on the trigger. You're not supposed to go over. Fire bursts of six. Every sixth one is a tracer. Fire bursts of six. Fire bursts of six. That's to keep the barrel cool.
Mm-hmm.
It's water cooled. The tube is put down into the ground so the enemy can't see the steam coming up. It produces steam in a short while. But you don't want to hurt your barrel. You have a spare barrel. If you burn it out, and if it gets too hot and burn it out, you have to twist it out, put a new barrel in there, and bring it out and click it back. And hope you got the clicks back, because if you make it too tight, the shell will fracture and you're out of business until you can get it out of there. You've got to put it a little bit short and then tighten it a notch or two. No, I did not think, what am I getting myself into? I was so, please believe me, I was so damn patriotic to see what we were doing. We had plenty of food. We had plenty of ammunition. There was 90,000 troops on the ocean when I was going across.
Mm-hmm.
I was on that ship for 40 days. We stopped off at Mariani for a beer party. What that is you climb down the rope ladder and they bring some ham sandwiches and you have a little beer party, and if you're lucky enough you can get a clean shower, because on the ships it's all salt water.
Mm-hmm.
For troops. I was walking around one of the bone piles, junkyard, and I see this can of food, never been opened yet. I figured, you know what, let me take that on the ship with me. So we took some beer with us going back, and we took our shovels and popped the end off, and it was beautiful chipped beef. Everybody had a hand in it. We didn't care if we got sick because it was enjoyable. So, yes, a machine gunner is dangerous. That's why, well, first of all, the officer threw his binoculars. I'm a poor farm kid. Never seen barbed binoculars in my life, half decent. So I picked it up and put it inside my shirt. After things kind of settled, I took it out and was looking around, and, well, zing, right through my shoulder. Mm-hmm. So it was a sniper. Later on at the Army reunions, one of the guys told me, he says, when they found the guy, they counted 60 shots. He was up in the palm tree.
Mm.
So I got up and I started running. I run about 10 feet. The blood is squirting out. I'm hollering, medics, medics, and I fell down. So my medic comes and, Garabinier, where's your medical kit? I says, it's on the Jeep. I said, I didn't want to carry it. So they gave me a shot of morphine. They patched me up. That's the only patching up I got until I got to Hoanya, New Guinea. So this is an interesting part. They managed to get me on a stretcher, and a fellow by the name of Medziak out of Chicago, he was underneath the bush. He reached down and grabbed a hold of my stretcher, and one hand pulled me underneath that bush. It took another half hour before the firing. You don't fire all day long. It just goes in spurts. So then at about 5:30 in the evening, the Jeep came by, and they put three of us on and took us back 14 miles to the field hospital. And my God, we got there. When we got a couple hundred feet from there, we had to stretch a cable on a track layer that was there for this purpose, just to pull the Jeeps or the trucks through the mud, because the mud was so deep. They actually slid the vehicles through there. They put me in a tent. And guy says, contending me, he says, where's your dog tag? I says, it left the back on a Jeep. He says, that's a heck of a place to leave it. He says, how am I going to know who you are? Well, it's plain English. I'm Joseph Garabedian, 39421644 is my serial number. Okay, so he put that on a shipping tag, put it around my neck, and that night I was in that tent dark, just pitch dark. I felt something coming out of my mouth, so I guess it must have been blood. And I took that shipping tag and I wiped my mouth with it. The next morning when he comes in, somebody comes in to see who I am, tend to me. He said, where's your dog tag? How come you got your dog tag all dirty? I said, well, I had to wipe my blood out of my mouth. Well, anyhow, then they took me into the field hospital, cleaned me up, put me on a hospital ship. That afternoon, I was on the way to Hoanya. The ship was not a troop ship. It was a roomy, like a passenger ship, but it was a hospital ship. We had beds to sleep in. We had commodes. It took us, I think, I don't know, 2 weeks or so to get there, maybe 3 weeks, I don't know. Had a little constipation problem. So when I got there, the guy that was in charge of me, he says, okay, I've read your orders. Here's your bedpan. I said, what's a bedpan for? He says, you have to use it. I said, I don't like a bedpan. I won't use it. I don't know how to use it. He says, my orders say you have to use it. So I used it. He says, you will never use a bedpan again under my watch. Anyhow, I was there until I think about the 19th of December. I was happy there, even though I got nothing but a turkey tail.
So I'm going to bounce around with you a little bit. The reason I asked about the machine gunner thing, so this is a heavy thing to carry. You've got to carry the barrel, the tripod. Someone's got to carry some ammunition.
Yeah, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, about 5 ammunition bearers. The gunner and the second gunner take turns, but when they get tired, they'll let us handle it, which we enjoyed it. So you got about 4 ammunition bearers. Each can's got 650 rounds a minute, plus the one that is going in, and you don't sleep on it. It's like on, not like on the movies where they just fall asleep on the trigger. It's the fire bursts at 6 and you stop. And you come down a trail real nice. You don't even have to look through a sight, because you can see where it's hitting. Every 6th one being a tracer, just automatically you can just bring yourself right down that path. And it's got a good sight at a mile. The M1 rifle was the same shell that used the Garand, the same shell that the machine gunner belt had, and the same shell that fit in the carbine, which was a 15 shell clip.
Well, I'm just curious. I mean, I'm guessing you had to know that the odds are more against you if you're part of a machine gun squad, because you're a bigger target for the enemy. You're the one they want to take out.
But you know, there's certain things, again, please believe me, patriotism that stays with you, and you're living through hell anyhow. You're living through hell anyhow, so you just as well do what the guys did at Gettysburg or where else, or Washington crossing the Delaware. We're all the same people. It's the same country. How this country did this in 250 years, I don't know. But yes, we knew, but you can't say nothing. You can't back out.
Did they tell you this is how long the average machine gunner lasts in combat?
It's in writing. 3 minutes.
3 minutes of combat.
Yes.
You're going to be killed or wounded.
Yeah, in 3 minutes they'll spot you. That's why you want to fire for burst of 6 or 3 or 4 times and then move. You don't stay in the same spot. Now, some of these places that make their surroundings out of concrete and everything else, like German did and all that, once you throw a grenade, you got the whole outfit.
So you're 20 years old. You've never been in combat before. And you're landing at Leyte. And this is part of a larger plot because the Americans had been in the Philippines. They'd been either captured or chased out. Thousands of them are on the Bataan Death March. MacArthur gets out of there, but he says, I shall return. And the day that he actually fulfilled that promise was the day you were landed on the same beach?
Yes. We landed on the 20th. On the 27th, we turned left on Tanawan. And then on the 28th, we were going into the Kailing. That evening when all this action came on and I got wounded, I read where they had to go back 1,000 feet and regroup and start all over again to go into Kailing. That's when most of the fighting started. There wasn't too much fighting before there. On Catman Hill and some of those places there was, it was very slow, but it picked up. They weren't too prepared.
So what was happening right before you got hit?
I was looking through my binoculars like this, behind the gun itself. But there was, just before that, a mortar shell blew up behind us, and actually none of us got any shrapnel, but the noise was deafening. It was rather quiet, but then all it takes is one fake shooter, and you got a bunch of people shooting. I remember the first action we got there, we were shooting up into a palm tree, and in a few seconds, the whole palm tree was pruned. The officer was, stop it, you know. It's amazing how they would be able to hide in a palm tree. There's not that much place to hide up those trees.
And you've made it clear how patriotic you felt, how important this was for you to do this for your country. But as you're entering into combat for the first time in your life, were you scared? Were you nervous? Anxious?
As long as you're whole, you're scared as hell. Well, if you get wounded. Now, when I got wounded, I didn't even think of dying. I don't know why. All I knew is I sprung up, ran about 10 feet, and fell, like I said a while ago. You're in it now. You're in it. I didn't get into the tough fighting where they did in Okinawa. So I got letters from some of the guys. They said there was, you think Leyte was hell. This is altogether hell because they had thousands of people. They lost 1,000 soldiers. We lost 17,000. They're ready for us. They're, you know, it's like football, offense, defense. They're on defense. They know your spot. They know exactly. They've got their mortars all tuned in, and they know exactly where it's going to fall.
And when you got hit, what did that feel like?
Like a bee sting. Believe me, it didn't hit any bones, I guess that's why, like a bee sting.
So it came in not too far from your head, a couple inches?
Right here, yeah.
Right on your left shoulder.
I think he was trying to hit my head.
Good thing he missed. But he didn't miss by much.
No.
So it goes in vertically, almost, on your left shoulder, and exits down near your tailbone, kind
of? No, in the center of my back.
Right in the center of your back.
Half inch from my spine, I'd have been paralyzed.
Yeah.
That shakes me. In fact, it shakes the doctors when they see it to be that close to the spine.
It's kind of hard to do that. There's a lot of bones that he had to miss.
Well, that's probably where that blood came into my mouth. You know, people ask me, well, how did you get blood through your mouth? I guess it must have been some of that internal injuries.
What about your arm? Did you have the use of that left arm at all?
I didn't have the use of that arm for more than a year. I was in the hospital. From that point on, I got discharged on November 45. We entered the United States in back again on the 2nd of January of 45. I got discharged. The end of 45, I got discharged.
Mm-hmm.
My arm was useless. Even now, when the weather gets real cold, this arm is useless because I got a 30% disability on it.
Well, it sounds almost miraculous you were ever able to use it at all.
I use it for everything.
But I'm thinking about the first 30 minutes that you're wounded, because you described it. They get you on a stretcher, but you're still out there, and they're still firing all around you, and your buddy's able to pull you under a bush.
I've often wondered how they got me on the stretcher, but Mesiak was the only one under the bush within reach of me, and he pulled it underneath. I guess what happened was they spread out once they got me on the stretcher, and that stretcher is on legs or something, and he's a big, great big Polack, great big Polack. Too bad he had to die. He grabbed me and pulled me underneath.
What do you think would have happened to you if he didn't do that?
They would have nailed me.
They would have seen you.
Yeah. It's hard to say what would have happened. It wasn't too far. But that wasn't very much action. 8 days. Was it worth it? All the training? Now, did the government lose money on me or did they make?
Well, I think everyone's going to form an opinion about that by the time we're done here. But you had a long journey. I mean, you just said you didn't have the use of your arm for a year.
Yes.
So this is a long time that you're dealing with this daily. When they first get you to a place where they can help, is it sinking into you that you may never be able to use this left arm again?
No, because I was always aggressive. When I came back in 1946, I had my truck and trailer. I was able to use my arm to haul bricks, sand, and gravel for our building. And by February, we were in business. I run the lathe for 13 years. I'd never seen a lathe before. But you learn those things. You're aggressive. It's your chance. You got to do it.
Sounds like you never took anything for granted either.
Listening to my father's stories? No. I'm just thankful that my mother and father were able to come to this country. And not only my mother and father, millions of other people came to this country for a reason. Safety and food. At least they would say that when you go to bed at night, you know that you're going to wake up in the morning.
And you're going to wake up free. We get to do that here in America. And 80 years ago this weekend, they finally got to do that in the Philippines. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.